The New Covenant reading is taken from the letter of the Revelation of Jesus Christ, Revelation chapter 17. I'd like to begin at verse 6 this evening. We actually looked through verse 8 last week, but I think since several of you weren't here last week, it'll make a bit more sense if we start at verse 6. Revelation chapter 17, beginning at verse 6. The word of our God. And I saw the woman, drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. But the angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman, and of the beast with seven heads and ten horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was, and is not, and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will marvel to see the beast, because it was, and is not, and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven. And it goes to destruction. And the ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour, together with the beast. These are of one mind and hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful." The angel said to me, "The waters that you saw, where the prostitute is seated, are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the ten horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked, and devour her flesh, and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth." God is absolutely sovereign. He's in charge of everything. Every detail of the universe answers to the Lord's command. And that is good news. About 8 or 9 years ago, there was a big kerfluffle that came up in the broader evangelical world over the doctrine of justification. It was actually caused in part by one of the finest New Testament scholars of our day, N.T. Wright, who, for reasons that entirely baffle me, is just really fuzzy on the doctrine of justification. I don't get why someone who's so smart and knows the Bible so well is confused over this particular central doctrine of the church. But there it is. He is. But one of the things that led to is other people that saw their role as being defenders of the Reformed faith against this person who was introducing perhaps fuzzy and maybe even wrong ideas, was that when N.T. Wright spoke about the gospel or spoke about justification, they were quick to say, "Look, that's wrong." And I remember about 8 or 9 years ago when N.T. Wright was talking about the good news of the gospel. And he said, "The good news of the gospel, not exhaustively, but it includes this truth, our God reigns." And three men, who I admire greatly, all came up and said, "What kind of good news is that, that God reigns? That's not good news, right? What the good news is that Jesus died for my sins, not simply that God's in charge," which actually should warn all of us, because we're tempted to make that leap without thinking through what's going on, thinking back through what the Bible actually says. Because back in Isaiah 52, a passage that's dealing with the gospel itself, we actually hear a very different story. See, Isaiah prophesied about the judgment that God was bringing upon Israel through Babylon because of their rebellion. And he sent them into captivity. But then God gave an Isaiah a vision for the future of looking forward to the time when God would restore Israel. And it turns out that God did not fully restore Israel by bringing 50,000 people back out of Babylon, a small remnant. We never then see the Holy Spirit, for example, filling the temple. And that's the whole point of being God's people. God would dwell in our midst, right? And say, I will be your God and you will be my people. And so Isaiah looks forward to the day when the Lord will return to Zion. You know, you see that in the book of Malachi, for example, that the one in the who's like Elijah, we know that's John the Baptist, is going to come, God is going to send him before the Lord. And so the people are waiting. The messengers come, and then the Lord himself is going to return to Zion and lift them up. The reason why I say that it's such a terrible mistake, because you want to react against those fuzzy ideas that came out by rejecting everything that a man says, is when we come to Isaiah 52, we're actually told there these very famous words. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news. That's the gospel, right? How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who publishes peace, who brings good news of happiness, who publishes salvation, who says to Zion, what does he say to Zion? Your God reigns. God says the fact that God reigns is good news. See, it's not good news in the abstract that there's a God out there somewhere in the distance who's in charge of everything. The reason why our God reigning is good news is because God uses his power to judge his enemies, to vindicate and deliver his people, and to glorify his holy name. But beloved, I want you to see this because tonight as we turn to Revelation chapter 17, at the very heart of tonight's passage is the truth that there's good news in our God reigning. I want to say up front, this is a very challenging passage to interpret the details of. Many commentators are quite up front and they'll say, I don't know what this means. I appreciate that. You may actually hear me say that occasionally this evening. What I'm going to try to do for you this evening, though, is to be clear and in saying some things are pretty clear, some things are not very clear at all, and I'm actually going to stretch out a bit and speculate. Those are not throwaway lines. I want you to pay attention to that. So you understand that when I'm stretching to help you understand the passage, you don't go home and say, boy, that would be great. We should start a whole movement on that idea. No, the main things are the plain things, and the plain things are the main things, and there's not a lot in this passage tonight that's particularly plain. We begin in verse 6. Here we're told, and I saw the woman. Now, who is this woman? This woman has been described as Babylon, but also described as the harlot. And last week we saw that the reason why this city is described as a harlot is because she's so alluring. It's something that's intrinsically bad from one standpoint, but she's clothed in beautiful apparel. And she's enticing to the people of this world. Enticing because, if we understand that she's the great city at any particular time that has risen up against God, that's where the power is. That's where the money is. That's where the culture is. That's where the prestige is. And by the way, those are all good things. Right? So don't read this passage and think God is saying, well, earning money is a bad thing, or even becoming wealthy is a bad thing. That's not what the passage is saying. But the harlot has all these good things that people want, Christians and non-Christians alike, and it uses them to lure people to lessen their allegiance to God and to grant their allegiance to the state. And ultimately, the powers of Satan and the demons behind the beast, behind the harlot, are what they really want to do is get you to the point where you worship the beast, where you worship the harlot, where that's where your ultimate loyalties belong. And I want to say this evening, we shouldn't imagine that we're immune. Everybody is tempted by these things because they're actually good in and of themselves. They're not bad. And I heard just this afternoon, Kristen and I were listening to a sermon by a fine pastor Vodi Balcom, and he makes actually a really good point about a temptation that comes with the harlot. We have a saying in our culture that we tell young children. If everybody jumped off the bridge, would you jump too? You know, your parents said that to you. You'll say it to your children someday. You really will. You will. But we say that as though it's so obvious that, no, you shouldn't jump, and as though it's easy to resist what everybody else is doing. But actually, if you're all self-aware, you realize that when everyone else is doing something, it's naturally attractive for us to do it too. And that's actually part of the seductiveness of this great, powerful, wealthy city. It's shiny. It has things that we want. And all the movers and shakers are saying, I want a piece of it. And it's very hard to step back and say, you know what, I want a piece of it too, but not at the cost of my relationship with Jesus Christ. Let goods and kindred go, this mortal life also. The body they may kill, God's truth abideth still. Well, we sing it. But you know, in that day-to-day life, particularly when it's not so dramatic and it's subtle, it's very hard to let the goods and kindred go, to let our friendships go, to cling in faithfulness to Jesus. So we want to appreciate this harlot is very seductive. But we also have been given a vision. John was given a vision that showed that she wasn't just shiny and covered in gold and royal apparel. On the inside, it was despicable. She had a cup filled with abominations. And we're told here in verse 6 that this woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs, that is, the witnesses to Jesus Christ. And so that ought to make us have a degree of pause before we go pursuing all the great power brokers in the world and asking ourselves, what do they require of us in order to give us the things that they promise? I mentioned last week, so we're looking at this beast, that is the civil government that is empowered and motivated by Satan and the demonic forces, that the harlot represents the lead city of that system at any particular time in history. So if it's not one particular harlot, this city rises up, and it might be at one time Egypt, another time Assyria, another time Babylon, another time Rome, maybe New York or London or whatever else it might be. I didn't mention this last week, but I do want you to actually look down with me at verse 18, because I'm not going to comment on this probably again at the end of the sermon. I just want you to see I'm not winging that. It's right here in the passage. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. We're going to see more about this in the next 2 weeks. When we look at chapter 18, we see Babylon falling. But the idea is if you think of any great city at any great time in history, first century, they would have naturally thought of Rome, by far the biggest city of the day. That's where the money is. And so if you're a lesser kingdom, a lesser city, what you want to do is trade with Rome. Your business people are going to get wealthy having their ships go to and from Rome and engaged in trade, right? And so it's this city that is empowered by satanic forces rising up against God. Now, in the first century, the Christians would have all recognized right away that Rome fit that bill because the Roman emperors demanded worship. So clearly they were putting themselves in the place of God. The Roman emperors actually called themselves Savior and Lord, titles in the New Testament, of course, given to Jesus. And interestingly, they also called themselves Son of God. And so you can see there's a parody here of who God really is. But that principle is true throughout history. But here's a really, really big warning I have for you. So please listen to this. The passage is not telling us, and the book of Revelation is not telling us, that civil governments are bad, even big civil governments. Right? The point here isn't civil government bad, lowly farmers good. This is a specific type of civil government, civil governments that have set themselves up over against God and are demanding absolute allegiance from their subjects. Of course, in the 20th and 21st century, we can see many major powers who have done that. And others, like the United States, who haven't actually done that, but do it in part, do it in bits, right, and move in that direction. So this isn't like throwing a light switch where it's either all or nothing, right? But I don't want you to think that all civil governments are bad. I think of Queen Elizabeth, who said that she hoped she was still going to be alive when Christ returned so she could cast her crown at his feet. Beloved, that is not a civil government that's part of the beast. The beast is not civil government in general. It's a specific type of civil government animated to exalt itself at the expense of exalting Jesus Christ. I know that's a lengthy reminder from last week, but I think it'll help us understand the rest of this passage. And so John says, when I saw her, I marveled greatly. I mentioned, I think that makes a lot of sense. I would have marveled greatly too. But of course, the angel is not rebuking John for marveling when the angel says, why do you marvel? Because he doesn't say, why do you marvel? You should understand it. He says, why do you marvel? I'll reveal it to you. I will give you the information that explains it. I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with seven heads and 10 horns that carries her. Let me step back again, particularly for the benefit of you who have not been here for the last few weeks. Remember that Satan himself appears as a red dragon with this exact description of 7 heads and 10 horns. And then we see the political beast having 7 heads and 10 horns. That is, it represents Satan in the political realm that's rising up against God. And we actually saw last week for the first time that this beast was also described as being scarlet while the harlot rode him. So we can't miss the connection between Satan and Satan's inspired government. Verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. There's two aspects of that I want to make sure you have before you. The first is there's a parody of Jesus. Jesus who was and is to come. Here we have the beast who was and is not and is to come. I think John intends us to get that. But there's also that more basic reality that the beast is manifesting itself in history by different empires coming up. And so when the Roman Empire collapses, or when the Babylonian Empire collapses and taken over by the Persians, we shouldn't go, ooh, the beast is gone. What we should say is that manifestation of the beast is gone, but the Persians actually took their place, and later on the Greeks and the Romans, and throughout history. Right? So that's part of this. It's not that there's just one kingdom in view. It's the beast in a spiritual sense that keeps rising up again from the pit. And John says, though, it's about to go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast. And I don't think I've mentioned this to you before, at least not recently. But that expression, dwellers on the earth, I actually like Greg Beale, a very fine scholar, says earth dwellers. Earth dwellers is opposed to those who have their citizenship in heaven. It doesn't mean everyone who happens to be living on earth at any given point of time. This is the people who do not have their citizenship in heaven, who do not have their minds and their thoughts set on things above. That is, they're not Christians. So earth dwellers in the book of Revelation always refers to unbelievers. And they marvel about the beast because they put their hope in the beast. They thought the beast was invisible, invincible. Then we're told in verse 9, this calls for a mind with wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman is seated. Beloved, I want to say that if all you want to do is identify the city there, it doesn't take a great deal of wisdom. Everybody in the first century goes, city on 7 hills, Rome. And that's right. John does have Rome in view. But what takes wisdom is understanding that it's not just Rome. And fitting it together with the rest of what he's already told us, we understand that this city of Babylon, this spirit that's against God, existed in ancient Babel, it existed in ancient Egypt, it existed in Assyria and in Babylon and the Persian Empire and the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire, and it exists beyond the Roman Empire. And the second thing that it takes wisdom to understand is what difference does this make for the people of God? See, one of the pieces of good news about God's exhaustive sovereignty is God is telling us what's really going on in the world. See, God's revelation is a beautiful thing for us. You could not figure this out by yourself. If God hadn't given us this revelation in the book of Revelation, some other passages, for example, in the book of Daniel, we would not understand what's going on. We wouldn't be able to see the attraction of these empires and realize they're satanic. We'd just be guessing. But God reveals it to us because he controls it in exhaustive detail. And he reveals it to us because he wants us to understand it precisely so we won't get lured in, so that we'll flee from Babylon. Next week, we're going to see the call that God has for his people to come out from her. He doesn't mean by that that Christians are to leave the world. He does, however, mean we ought to leave the worldly system and its allurements. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings. Well, you need revelation for that. By the way, in apocalyptic literature, it's very common to mix metaphors and also to use the same metaphor to mean more than one thing. So you have to be really careful about being too literal. I give you an example from outside of, well, it's used in apocalyptic literature, but you can think of it in non-apocalyptic literature too. Is a lion a good thing or a bad thing? If you understand that Satan roams around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he will devour, you might think, I got it. In the Bible, a lion is a bad thing. Until you remember that Jesus is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. So you have to be very careful about taking these as one-for-one correspondence, like you're reading a, what is the name for it? Pilgrim's Progress. What do you call Pilgrim's Progress? No. Allegory, thank you. Like an allegory. See, now we have an interactive sermon. Like an allegory. Apocalyptic literature is not an allegory, and so sometimes the same symbols mean different things. And right here you're told that the seven hills actually represents seven different things. Two different things. On the one hand, it represents Rome, the present manifestation of the beast in John's day, but it also represents seven mountains on which the woman, that is the harlot, is seated. There are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As you can imagine, a lot of ink has been spent on identifying these seven kings. Five who have fallen, one who is, one more who will be for just a little while. There's actually only two major approaches. The first is a historicist approach, that is, trying to identify these seven kings historically, and there's two versions of that. The first one goes something like this. Obviously, the king who is the king in John's day. And if we only knew exactly when John wrote the gospel, we could identify it. But clearly, there are seven Roman emperors. You know, I keep saying clearly, but I don't really mean clearly. I'm just saying it gets presented that way. Clearly, it's seven Roman emperors. And if you only hear one version of this, it can sound pretty convincing. You know, you get Nero in the right place. Everyone's trying to get Nero and Domitian in the right place because those are two particularly heinous emperors in terms of how they treated Christians. The problem is you can go home and read about Roman history, and very quickly you find out that from Julius Caesar to Domitian, there are 12 Caesars, not seven. And what you'll find is all the commentators have their own special mix. They leave some out, they skip some, they go, he wasn't too significant. And very soon you realize it's entirely arbitrary. And that can't be what John is doing. I should add, by the way, that's not the way the number seven actually works in the book of Revelation. Let me set that aside for a moment. You'll realize that you can't start with any of them. You can't start with Nero and go to Domitian. You can't start with Julius Caesar. No matter how you do it, it's arbitrary. It's not what God is doing here. So some people, recognizing that it can't be seven particular Caesars, have said the seven kings are seven kingdoms. And that actually works out pretty conveniently, particularly if you're a wee bit selective on how you pick them. Egypt, right? Egypt persecutes God's people. God delivers them. The Assyrian Empire, Babylon, Medo-Persia. Well, you can't do Persia separately, so you got to do Medo-Persia, otherwise you run out of fingers. But the Medo-Persian Empire, then Greece, those are the five kingdoms that have fallen. The one who is the Roman Empire. And it seems like we're on to something, even though we are being a bit arbitrary. But you should realize that leaves you with a problem. Unless Christ came back when the Roman Empire fell, or right after that, it doesn't work. Because we're told in the passage after the sixth empire falls, well, the sixth hill falls, the seventh one will only rule for a short period of time. And those interpreters have to take you know, all the kingdoms since the fall of Rome. The rise of Germany and Portugal and Holland is a great trading power, and the British Empire and the United States, and lump us all together as one empire and then say we're only involved in having power for a little while. It just doesn't work. What I hope you can see by now, particularly if you've been staying with us, the book of Revelation, is that's not what John uses these numbers for. The number seven normally, almost all the time, simply means complete. And so when he talks about the seven kings for the beast, he's saying, look at them in their totality. Seven is all of them. All of them. And so when you talk about five have fallen, one is, and one's to come just for a little time, it fits right in the context of chapters 16 and 17, where he's saying, I'm now talking about the end of history. I'm not just talking about the sweep of history from the beginning to the end. I'm talking about that period of time that's close to the end of history. We have a king, or a kingdom, doesn't matter really which, that's ruling as the beast in history, as the prominent city, as the prominent empire, and that one's going to fall. There's going to be one more, but that last one's only going to be there for a little bit of time. And that actually makes sense of the passage, the way that Revelation itself uses numbers and uses language. So we're told in verse 10, they are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth. That's hard. It is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. I mentioned Vodi Balcom, and I like, he says, I'm going to cut to the chase here. I just don't know what this means. I want to second that motion, but I think we can say a little bit more than that. I think we actually can understand this at least in part. First, I want you to see that if the number seven was applying literally to seven kings and not symbolically to all the kings together, this can't work. The eighth king can't be part of the seven if there's just seven in a sequence. It does, however, work if the number seven refers to all of them. Then it wouldn't surprise us that this eighth king would be part of all of the kings. That fits. The way the number eight often works in the Bible, it's not nearly as common as the word number seven, is it suggests the very next thing. Could be the number of resurrection, for example. But I want to suggest in this context, it represents a special manifestation of the beast, that is the very last one. And I told you earlier, I'm going to give you those warnings when I'm going out on a little bit of a speculative limb. Here I am. I'm out on the speculative limb. But I want to say that I think the most natural way to read this, the way that puts most of the evidence together, is to see this beast, which is part of the totality of the kings, part of the seven, but is also the eighth, is this is the last one. This is the last rule. And we're going to see how this gets fleshed out more when we get, for example, to Revelation 20. I'll say a bit more about that in just a moment. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. And the ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are of one mind and hand over their power and authority to the beast. So the idea of these ten kings is they're lesser magistrates. They do actually have positions of authority. They may have even been a king like King Herod. I don't mean that's literally a connection, but just to give you an idea in your mind. But everybody in the Roman Empire knew who was in charge. Caesar was in charge. Right? They didn't have that kind of royal authority to act on their own behalf. What this passage is saying is this group of lesser rulers is also going to give their allegiance to the beast, to this system of government where the government is set up over against the saints. That's the idea. And when they do that, they're going to get power. See, they actually are doing this out of selfish motives. As I show allegiance to this beastly system as one of these lesser magistrates, I gain greater power. Right? And that's what they want. And so we're told the ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings. 1 hour is a short period of time together with the beast. These are of one mind and hand over their power and the authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb. So we shouldn't be surprised when we see lots of nations around the world or lots of states in the United States getting together, not necessarily as an organized conspiracy at first, but simply saying, yeah, you know, we're tired of those Christians and their hateful rhetoric and all the things they do, and they oppose us. God tells us right here they will make war against the saints. But here's the good news of God's absolute sovereignty, of the absolute sovereignty of Jesus Christ, who has said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. Because he's not some petty magistrate. He is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. See, he's going to defend those whom he has sovereignly called into his kingdom, who has chosen, that is election, to be his people, chosen them in himself, right? We've been chosen in Jesus Christ and who are walking with him. Should say the book of Revelation has no category for those who have been called and chosen but are, quote, badly backslidden, who are living like the world. Apocalyptic literature is normally very black and white, but it should be a reminder to us that we're called not simply to make a decision for Jesus, but to follow him, to bear his burdens, to take up our cross daily and follow him, even being willing to suffer the reproach of the world that we might be called part of the people of God. Verse 15, and the angel said to me, the waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. Last week we saw that Babylon is a city on water, on canals. That same image is being brought forward here, but we're seeing that the water is actually symbolic. It's a way of saying this harlot, this lead city that's raised up against God, has a type of dominion that spans across nations. I'm over all these peoples from different nationalities and people groups and languages. This is a government with great power and can be impressive. And you can think through history of those that have held this, and the United States is certainly one of them. This is a superpower that has set itself up against God. But here's the startling thing, which is also good news for us. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate, naked, and devour her flesh, and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And we're going to end here on these pieces of good news. There's 3 pieces of good news to remember tonight. The first is that the Lord Jesus Christ is the King of kings and Lord of lords, and therefore he conquers our enemies when our enemies come against us. But there's 2 pieces of good news right in this passage. The first is it might be rather surprising to discover that the harlot, who actually is up over the beastly government, is now going to be attacked by these lesser magistrates who have united with the beast. But they do. They do actually take that action. That is, God's enemies are not only crushed directly by God, they end up devouring themselves. That's something we should remember in this world. We should remember that the kingdom of Jesus Christ is a kingdom based on love and loyalty on God's perfect work. But the kingdoms of this world that set themselves up over against the church and over against Jesus Christ, they're all about grasping. And you know what happens when one group of graspers comes into another group of graspers? They each try to take away from each other. They want to be king of the hill. And so while petty nations in the world might look to a superpower like the United States with one hand and say, I want to have an allegiance to them, I want to have a trade loyalty with them so I can benefit, they also look and say, boy, I hope they get their comeuppance. Not simply that we're brought down, but we're brought down and they're lifted up. And that's why poor people around the world actually celebrated at 9/11. If you remember that, right? Particularly in the Arab world, but it was not just there. They were happy to see America get theirs. That takes place here at the end of history, at the very end of history. But the second piece of good news I want you to see with this is it isn't just the natural outcropping. We're told in verse 17, for God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. Never forget that the king's heart is in the Lord's hand. Never forget that the Supreme Court justice's heart is in the Lord's hand. Right? We don't have anything to fear. God's exhaustive sovereignty goes even to the motivations, the hearts, and the actions of his enemies. God is in charge. So what does he actually do? Well, you can think of this as, by example, to some of the lesser military conquests in the Old Testament. This is not the only time God does this in history. Think of Gideon, for example. How does Gideon win a battle? Does he raise up a large army with swords and clubs and they go out and courageously fight their enemy? No, they've got torches and trumpets and they blow them. And God causes their enemy to fight against each other and kill themselves. That's on a small scale. This is on a massive scale at the end of history. God will cause his enemies to devour each other, even as he himself will conquer them. Well, how do we fit this all together? I'm going to risk something tonight, because you're a very smart group. You are. But please remember that what I'm about to say is not literally true. I want to give you a picture of how to tie these things together. But what I am not saying, please hear me, I am not saying the United Nations is the last beast that is going to rise up on the face of the earth. It may be that Christ does not come back for 20,000 years and the United Nations is a forgotten footnote on advanced AP history exams. Right? I am not saying that. But I'm going to give you an illustration so you can see how this fits together. Imagine for a moment that an organization like the United Nations suddenly starts to get power motivated by Satan and demonic forces. That is, Satan comes and says, that's how I want to manifest my kingdom in this world. And the lesser nations come together through that organization and say, we will give you our power. Sure, we'll let you tax in our countries. We'll send you more troops. Because what we really are concerned about is it benefits us and tears down whoever happens to be the big wheels of that day, Japan, Britain, China, United States. And you actually see here in this picture of all these lesser magistrates coming together to devour the superpower of that day. And so this transnational organization actually has increased power, greater and greater. It, in fact, becomes a one-world superpower sort of government, animated by Satan. If that's, in fact, correct, with something like that, not that exactly, but something like that is going to happen, then we can understand why we have this eighth king. Because this eighth king participates in the beastly system, but is distinct from it. Instead of being the harlot after all is destroyed when this happens, instead of being another manifestation of the harlot, another Babylon, it's actually uniting all the governments on the face of the earth that are against God together in one great power. And we come to Revelation chapter 20, we're going to see that when Satan is released from the bottomless pit, he organizes all the people of the world that are against God to go out and fight against his saints. Right? Doesn't that fit with this? Well, I think it does. I think it fits exactly with this passage. And so in that sense, this eighth kingdom is a kingdom that is, instead of being led rather indirectly by satanic forces while Satan is bound so he can deceive the nations no longer, perhaps it is this civil government lifting up itself up against God, now animated by Satan, who has been set free. And if that's true, we should think that's a really scary prospect until we remember that Jesus Christ is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Right? And so when we go home tonight, and we have no idea, of course, when this will happen, whether it's next year or 20,000 years from now, we ought to be encouraged as we confront this very problem to be tempted toward the harlot and also oppressed by the beast. We ought to be comforted by this very good news that no matter where you read in the scriptures, you hear this. Our God reigns. Beloved, whatever you go home tonight forgetting, don't forget that. It is good news to know that the God who loved you, who purchased you, who protects you right now, is in charge of everything. our God reigns. Amen.